This evening we're going to be studying about Esau and Jacob. I've titled this lesson Clashing Twins because that's exactly what they are. They are twin boys who don't often get along, and their descendants don't often get along. And we're going to be talking about them over the next few weeks, probably. There's more to say about them than I can put into one lesson. So we'll get some thoughts together today about their early lives, about some of the background for them, and one big formative event early on. And we'll continue with those thoughts in weeks to come. Just a little bit of background. You will remember that in Genesis 12, God made that big promise to Abraham, three big promises actually. He said that you will have a son, and through your descendants, there will be a great nation. They will grow to be like the sands of the sea, like the stars of the sky, and that nation will be great. They will inhabit a great land that I will give to them. And also through your descendants will come a blessing that will bless the entire world. That is one of the foundational things of Scripture, that those three promises right there. Because from that point, we are launched into the story of the history of Israel, how they come to be, how they came to be a nation at all. And then even more importantly, how the Messiah comes through Israel to bless not just the nation that he was a part of, but also the world, all nations, all peoples, past, present, and future. That's the story of the Bible right there. And so these three promises are instrumental in getting that narrative across, or getting that launched very early on in Scripture. But you know, there's kind of an interesting thing about God promising Abraham all these things through his lineage. He kind of struggles to have a lineage. They have to do a lot of work just to even get a son in the first place. Sarah was barren until a very old age. She laughed at the idea that she could ever have children. Genesis 16 tells us about that. They were barren for so long that Abraham and Sarah tried to help God's plan along. This is actually Sarah's idea. Sounds fairly absurd to us now, but Sarah says, why don't you take my maidservant, Hagar, go into her, have a son with her, and then we can have the child of promise that way. That seems incredible, but remember that she's in her mid-70s by this point. If you've made it to your mid-70s, you haven't had a son, and God's promised something with the lineage of Abraham, he's got to have a lineage for that promise to come true. And I guess God's just not going to do anything about that, so we'll figure out what's going to happen next. They do have a son, Abraham and Hagar. His name was Ishmael. And a nation would come from his descendants, but he is not the son of promise. And that is not the nation of promise that God had in mind. In God's time, Sarah gave birth to Isaac. And God made it clear to them, Isaac is the son of promise. This is the line that I was talking about. Didn't happen on their timetable, didn't happen just the way they thought it would, but it happened all the same. Ishmael's nation that would come from his line ends up in quite a lot of conflict with Isaac's line, as these things tend to go. But nevertheless, God makes good on his promise to Abraham. At least there I'm a short term. This is a long-term promise here, but it's going to take many generations to unfold. There's a lot more with Abraham's story, but if I try to tell all of Abraham's story, we'll never get to Jacob and Esau today. So Isaac grows up. He marries Rebecca. This is Genesis 24. They're married for 20 years, and oh no, they can't seem to have a kid. They're not getting pregnant. After 20 years of marriage, no baby is coming. And again, the lineage seems under constant attack. For a lineage that's supposed to grow to outnumber the sands of the sea and the stars of the sky, they really are trying hard to die out. And I suspect that this is because God is making a point here. That the nation that comes from Abraham will not be an accident. They will be a working of the Lord. Even if things don't always go according to man's plans along the way, they go according to God's plans. And some infertility is not going to be a barrier to God making good on this promise. I also think it shows God's sovereignty over being the source of life. Life ultimately comes from God. He is the creator of all things. This will be a foundation of faith for later generations as well. When the people encounter obstacles that threaten their survival, they can remember that God was able to overcome things like that in the past. So when they're up against the Red Sea, when they're up against the Jordan River, when they're up against the city of Jericho, when there are all these things that say the future of Israel is at stake, they can say, God's in control. God has that taken care of. Do not fear. And that's a good lesson for us as well. When we are up against things that are outside of our control but seem too much for us to handle, remember that God is in control. That doesn't necessarily make it easier for Isaac and Rebekah at this time, because they're 20 years into a marriage without a baby. And so Isaac prays to God for his wife, and God blesses them. Rebekah conceives. But things don't stay good. Even though I'm sure that was a time of joy, that yes, they're finally able to have a baby, there are problems in pregnancy, and that's scary. Rebecca is feeling violent things within her, and she's worried. She inquires of Yahweh. She says, if everything is okay, why is this happening to me? Genesis 25:22 says, in the English Standard, but I'm reading, it says that the children struggled together within her. Some other translations say the children pushed against each other, or they jostled each other. In actuality, none of those renderings are literally strong enough for what the Hebrew is. The Hebrew says that the babies were crushing each other in the womb. It is a violent word, a word that is invoking more of a violent fight than anything else. That's not really what you want to feel during pregnancy. That does not seem right and normal and healthy. These babies are somehow already not getting along. These babies are already at each other's throats while they barely have throats to be at. It's ridiculous. That's got to be disconcerting, if not terrifying. But the oracle says to Rebecca as an answer to this question, this is Genesis 25:23, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So this is a prophecy of conflict. It is not immediately an answer to her question about, you know, why is this happening and is this going to be okay. It indirectly answers that, because if their descendants can be fighting amongst themselves, well, then they must survive pregnancy and childhood and all of those things. But even still, this is a disconcerting kind of answer. It's an answer that's a lot more about their descendants than it is about them. Their descendants are not going to get along. They're going to fight with each other. And the younger brother's line will overpower the older brother's line, which is a reversal of what you would expect in the ancient order of things, with the older having more privilege and more power within a family. This oracle is not really about the personal problems that the brothers might have with each other. It's not telling Isaac and Rebecca that they should favor one over the other, but they do seem to interpret it that way, because we see some problems developing with some favoritism that we'll get to in just a moment. I have to imagine that this was a little strange for Rebecca to hear. She's obviously going to be more concerned and focused on the health and the safety of her babies. And here she's hearing all this information about what their descendants are going to do in the future and how they're going to be fighting and one will overpower the other. And she's like, I just want to have these babies. I just want them to be okay. Let's get to that point first. But these children are not just individuals. They're also future leaders of nations with roles to play in God's plan. The nations that will come from these twins are Israel and Edom. Both of those nations bear the names of these boys. Of course, they're named Jacob and Esau. Jacob will later get his name changed to Israel. And Edom is a nickname that later gets applied to Esau. We will discuss why in a few moments. And this is certainly not the last time that we will hear these names. Not just in this little series we're going to do on what these brothers' lives are like and how they fight amongst themselves and all of the deception and problems that come up. But throughout the story of the Bible, of course, there's a lot to say about Israel. There's a lot to say about Edom, too. And they do a lot of fighting over the years. But all that's skipping ahead. Let's not worry about the nations and the descendants just yet. Let's just talk about these two boys. The boys are born in due time. The older one comes out red and hairy. They name him Esau. The younger one comes out in kind of an unusual way. As he is born, he is holding on to his brother's heel. And so they name him Jacob. And in the typical ancient fashion, they gave him a name that has some meaning, that is connected to something about him or some wish for him. In this case, Jacob sounds like the Hebrew word for heel. It's not exactly the word for heel, but it sounds like it. And so it's meant to evoke that idea that when he was born, he was grabbing onto his brother's heel. But there's a little bit more to it than that. Because it also, kind of as a secondary meaning, means supplanter. One that overcomes, one that undermines. And that's what the oracle said about Jacob's line, right? That the younger would overcome the older. The older will serve the younger. This is the legacy of Jacob that will be established. The destiny that he has. He is the boy who's holding on to his brother's heel. Not just literally and physically when they're born. He will be the man who holds on to his brother's heel to pull him down and to raise himself up. We'll see that develop as time goes on. There are some diverging things that happen with these brothers. Esau and Jacob were not very similar to each other. Although they are twins, they are not particularly similar. Esau was a skilled hunter, and he was the pride of his father. He enjoyed going out to hunt game, to bring it back so that it could be cooked and eaten. And Isaac loved to eat the game that Esau was able to find. That was a great pleasure to him. Probably there was more to it than that as well. That they had personality traits in common or just reasons that they enjoyed each other. The point is that Isaac was particularly fond of Esau, and that was not a secret. It says that Jacob stayed closer to home. He remained in the tents, and that means he was probably handling more administrative tasks. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Rebekah favored Jacob. Maybe that's a reaction to Isaac's favoritism, or more likely, these things kind of develop in subtle and weird ways over the course of a childhood, right? Probably long before Esau could ever reliably bring back game to his father Isaac, did they have reasons for Isaac to favor Esau, for Rebekah to favor Jacob? Probably things to do with childhood, with personality, with all of the weird things that happen in family dynamics. Families are just fascinating, aren't they? We all have our own weird little things that go on in our families. And when you get a glimpse into someone else's family, sometimes you go, wow, they're just as weird as we are in a completely different way. So that's the way that it is. And this family we're talking about, well, they're just as weird as we are in a different way. They have these weird problems with favoritism. And it's going to cause problems as time goes on. Now, it is important to note that Isaac and his family were quite wealthy. The next chapter actually tells us specifically about that. But we also know that from a few different ways. You'll remember that Abraham had extensive flocks and herds. He had many servants. He had large amounts of wealth. Abraham was more than the leader of a family. He was basically the leader of a community. So don't imagine just some family kind of wandering their way, you know, through the wilderness. He is almost the head of his own little town. That's the kind of wealth that Abraham really had. They were semi-nomadic people. They dwelt in tents. This is very early on in human history when civilizations were popping up in different places, and some peoples were getting together to stay in one place, to have things like agriculture and industry develop that kept people in one spot. But there were still other peoples who were nomads or semi-nomadic in not always staying in one place, but sustaining themselves through flocks and herds and hunting and other sorts of things. That's just something that's happened over the course of human history, and we can see that from plenty of archaeological evidence. Abraham was that kind of person. He didn't live in a town, so to speak, but that didn't mean that he was poor or isolated. He had many servants, many who benefited from his wealth. And that wealth didn't disappear once Abraham died. It was passed on. And Isaac had a large amount of wealth as well. So I do not want you to imagine that it's Isaac and Rebecca and Esau and Jacob, and somehow they're just scraping by to survive out there in that wilderness. Oh no. These are wealthy people. You'll remember that Abraham and Isaac, for that matter, in the next chapter, both of them had enough influence and control and power and wealth that they negotiated with kings. Like, this is a big deal. So Jacob and Esau do not need to learn some sort of trade or learn something that allows them to survive just for sustenance, just for the basic elements of survival. They can do whatever they want to do. They have plenty of servants and plenty of wealth. So Esau can specialize in hunting. He can go out. He can learn how to hunt that game. He can learn to bring it back. It doesn't necessarily matter if he gets something or not, because this is not trying to get a little bit of food to make it through the winter. This is something between like sport hunting, but also more useful than that too, because they are eating this game, but it's not exactly just for basic subsistence. Jacob, on the other hand, can stay around the tent, stay in the main camp. And I said earlier that he was probably engaged in administrative tasks. That may not be what you think about with Jacob. Some people have the idea that Jacob was like a homebody, that he didn't do anything. He just kind of stuck around the tent with his mom. Some people have even thought, well, maybe that means he was kind of an effeminate person, maybe. None of that is really true. That's not the kind of thing that we're talking about here. When it says Esau went out to hunt and Jacob stayed in the tent, stayed in the camp, really for a position of the son of the patriarch of the family, that almost certainly means that he was overseeing servants, he was handling those sort of leadership tasks of the community that they are a part of. But they're pretty different. We don't have stories of Esau and Jacob going out and hunting together for the fun of it. We don't have stories of them getting along and enjoying themselves. We have stories of diverging brothers who are growing more different as time goes on. The stage has been set for problems between the twins. There's an oracle of conflict between their descendants that has been somewhat interpreted to mean that the brothers themselves must also have problems. There are parents who are clearly taking sides. And as we're about to see, there's some willingness on both sides to act in less than moral ways. Yeah, something's about to... One day, Jacob is away from the camp. and we know he's away from the camp because he is cooking a lentil stew. And for a person of Jacob's position, he is unlikely to be doing the cooking himself unless he is not around all of these other servants. So it also makes sense for him to be away from the camp because what it will happen with Esau in a moment doesn't make a lot of sense if he can just, you know, call up any servant who's nearby. So Jacob's out by himself, or mostly by himself. That much is clear. He's cooking a lentil stew. And Esau comes in from an unsuccessful hunting expedition, and he's hungry. Jacob has him alone here. They're away from the camp. Esau's in a somewhat vulnerable spot, and he sees an opportunity to take advantage. I don't know if Jacob was trying to get into that position to, or if this is an opportunistic sort of thing. I have a feeling it's opportunistic because it would be hard to make this fit together. But either way, Jacob is certainly going to seize the day while it is his. So Esau comes to Jacob. He sees him cooking that lentil stew, and he says, literally, "Give me some of that red there." Most every English translation I've seen inserts the word stew because, well, we kind of need that for clarity to know what he's talking about. Let me eat some of that stew. But it's so many of the English translations of this are like so polite about it, as if Esau is saying, "Hey, can I have a bowl of stew there?" That's not what this is. He's so eager, he's so like almost greedy about it that he's saying, "Give me some of that red." Doesn't even call it stew. It's just that red thing there. He is famished. He needs to eat. Jacob offers him a deal. "Trade me your birthright for this stew." What's a birthright? In the ancient world, they, like we do today, tended to give their inheritance, give the belongings of the parents, the wealth of the parents, to be passed on to the next generation, to their children after they have died. But they did it in a very particular way. The tradition was that your goods go to your sons. "Daughters, I'm sorry, you're the property of your husband. You don't get anything from your parents." That's just the way that that went. But they would divide it evenly among all the sons, except the oldest son had the birthright, which means he gets a double portion. So if in your family there are 10 sons, they would divide the inheritance up into 11 portions. Everyone gets one portion of it, except the oldest son gets two. And that's just the traditional way. I'm not saying that everyone did it that way, but that was the typical and traditional way that things worked. There was extreme importance put on being the oldest son. And as an oldest son, I'm all for it. I think it's great. So you will note that the difference feels a lot more extreme the fewer sons that there are. If you've got 10 sons and you divide this inheritance up into 11 portions, well, that's a lot of portions. And even if the oldest son's getting twice as much as anyone else, it's still only a small slice. With the situation that Esau and Jacob were in, there's only 2 sons. So that means they divide it up into 3 portions, and Esau, as the oldest and clearly better son, gets 2 portions, while Jacob gets 1. Well, that's just kind of dirty. That feels wrong if you're Jacob. That feels unfair, especially when you're a twin, especially when he is the older only by a few minutes at most. How come he gets double? Add on the fact that Isaac prefers Esau, and you can see that Jacob probably has a lot of bitterness building up within. Jacob's actions are still pretty hard to defend, though. He is acting in a very underhanded and dishonorable way, trying to cheat his brother of something that is, in fact, rightfully his. If Isaac wants to do things according to that traditional way, there is nothing morally or legally that should stand between him and doing that. Esau has done nothing wrong here. However, Esau is not guiltless. He has no thought for his birthright, and he says, "I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Now, it's hard to know if this is literally true, if Esau has come in from his hunting expedition literally on the brink of death, needing some morsel of food, or he's going to die momentarily, or if he's exaggerating. The language in the Hebrew is of Esau greedily wanting that stew. It's said in a somewhat crude way. I don't mean crude like immoral. Crude just as in not real delicate. Maybe like how we would say, let me stuff my face with that. You kind of get the idea. It's some level of like greed or gluttony or desperation or something that makes you word it that way. That's the kind of way that Esau is talking. Let me stuff my face with that bowl of red there. He really wants that stew. Unfortunately, it doesn't necessarily help us because that could be explained by both situations. If he's on the brink of death, then yeah, let me stuff my face with that bowl of red so I don't die. But if he's exaggerating and just tired and hungry and wants to eat, he might also say that as well. The birthright would just be an abstract thing to him, while the stew is the here and the now. The only clue that we're given is that the narrative says that he despised his birthright. He thought too little of his birthright, which leads me to think that he's exaggerating here. I think it's improbable that he would go out on a hunting expedition and stay out so long that he's literally about to die. And I find it improbable that he would be blamed so much for despising his birthright if he really is on the brink of death and has no choice here in the matter. Give Jacob what he wants or die. I think it's a lot more likely that he is exaggerating. He's hungry and tired, for sure. But he's exaggerating because he wants the fulfillment and the satisfaction of eating the stew when he is particularly exhausted. Either way, though, Jacob is taking advantage. Stew is not adequate payment for a birthright, no matter how good of a cook Jacob is. It just isn't. Jacob is using his brother's desperation or his thoughtlessness to seize something that isn't his. The honorable course of action in all of this would be to feed your brother. And do I really need to explain why? That's the normal, logical, honorable thing to do, particularly if he is that hungry, that desperate, that exhausted. You know, I've got my brother and his wife here for a few days. We've even fed them. And it didn't come up to talk about, you know, the future of our parents. I'm like, hey, Aaron, you can have some dinner if you want, but I need you to sign away your inheritance. Yeah. No, that's crazy. That's insane. You normal people don't do that. That is not a proper trade. And it really does not put Jacob in a good light here. I have read commentators and heard from people who really go too far, I think, in trying to extrapolate Esau's character and Jacob's character in working to create some sort of binary arrangement. I don't know why we want to do this. We want every situation to have one clear good guy and one clear bad guy. And so the explanation you hear sometimes, maybe you've heard this, is Esau was a wild man. He liked to go live life on the edge, go out and hunt, go out, and he probably had all these vices too. He didn't want to be at home with his family. He, wasn't responsible. He was just an evil, reckless kind of person. And Jacob, on the other hand, he was a simple, noble, moral kind of person who's staying at home with his mother there in the tent. No, that's not how this went down. That's not who they are. These are two boys who, to my reading, are probably a little spoiled, probably a little used to getting what they want and being able to do whatever they want, who don't seem to have the proper appreciation for their relationship with each other, their obligation as brothers, and the things that they have been blessed with. There's not really a clear good guy, bad guy here. These are some imperfect people who have a lot to learn. So it's this incident that gives Esau the nickname Edom. Edom is a word that sounds like the Hebrew word for red. So this is kind of like we actually do this sometimes too. You call a man red, or you call a person red. A lot of times we do it because of hair color. In this case, they were doing it not because of his reddish skin tone, as you might think, because when he was born, he was red and hairy. No, the text specifically tells us that it was because he sold his birthright for a bowl of red. So what could have been kind of a nice and cute nickname to some degree is actually a dishonorable one. It's a reminder of this terrible and dishonorable trade. The last thing I'll bring up in their story, in the story of Jacob and Esau, is something that Esau does after all of this. He seems to despise his family all the same, despise his family all the more. He takes two Hittite wives. This is found in chapter 26, verses 34 and 35, that he takes two Hittite wives against his parents' instruction. This is not what they wanted him to do. And it says that they caused Isaac and Rebekah much bitterness. And so this is a sign of Esau beginning to splinter off from his family, beginning to lose the favor of his father Isaac, beginning to be even more self-willed, self-motivated to do what Esau wants to do, regardless of the long-term consequences. Ah, here's my birthright. I don't need that right now. This bowl of stew is better. Here are these two Hittite women. I want to marry them. My parents don't approve. They don't want me to marry these pagan foreigners. And it seems that they were not good people anyway for bringing Esau's parents that kind of bitterness. We have a lot of problems developing in this story, and more will come because the clashing twins will continue to clash. And we'll talk more about that in some weeks to come. But just to make a couple of last applications for you tonight, think about this. One, you look at Jacob and Esau here, and it's kind of hard to call either of them at this point much of a man of faith, some pillar of righteousness. You know, Abraham's praised for his incredible faith. And Isaac has some good things said about him too. And at this point, Jacob just looks like a deceitful and greedy and kind of dishonorable person. And Esau doesn't look like he can think beyond this very moment. He's not taking any future consequences into account. These aren't really good people. Yet this is the story of how God will work through imperfect people to... They will not be the last ones in the story of Israel who are imperfect. Yet God's plan continues. And Jacob will learn and will do better. And to some degree, Esau will learn and do better. But even still, the story here is a lot more about God and God's faithfulness, God's ability to keep his promises, than it is about the failures and the weaknesses of the men that he is working through. He continues to do that today. Because when I look around this room, I see a bunch of sorry Jacobs and Esaus. That makes you all feel good, right? Well, me too, right? That's who we are. We're imperfect people who don't always get it right. We're people who sometimes put ourselves first, too often put ourselves first. We're people who don't think about future consequences. We're people who make too many mistakes. Yet has God's will been foiled? Is the kingdom in peril because we are not perfect? God works through even imperfect people. I'm not excusing our imperfection, mind you, because we need to strip away those things that are holding us back so that we can do better work in the kingdom to come, so that we can better glorify God tomorrow than we're doing today. But all the same, God can work through imperfect people, and he does it in every time and every place. He does it even here in this church. And that should be some comfort to you. to know that even with your weaknesses and even with your flaws, that God can still use you. And then take some of these lessons from Jacob and Esau as well on how they are not regarding things for the value that they truly have. Esau despised his birthright. Esau did not give enough, did not put enough value on the blessings that he had from his father. Jacob despised his brother. He didn't value the relationship he had with him, didn't value that brotherly bond enough to stop him from taking advantage of his brother. And that's part of the problem. We have to learn to value what God assigns value. He has blessed us in many ways. Value the sacrifice of Jesus. Value the church that he built. Value the world that he gave you to live in. Value the body that he gave you to inhabit. Value your brethren that work alongside, who work alongside you. I'm running out of steam. Value what God puts value on. And don't despise what is good. We will have lots of lessons to learn from Jacob and Esau in these weeks to come, but that will do for tonight. If we can help you in some way, if you're ready to be a child of God, or you need our prayers, you need our help, you need forgiveness, whatever your need is, come and let us know as together we stand and sing.